This is Dan Valanchis, bringing back our community podcast listeners with another episode. Today, I have the pleasure of having Nicole Heidenreich, a PA student at DeSales University, who's going to accompany me on this grand tour through thrombophilia profiles and the treatment and thoughts on delirium, particularly as it pertains to the hospitalized patient. So, without further ado, I'll hand it over to Nicole.
So, in reading this evidence-based approach to thrombophilia testing by a Mosqueda et al., the article talks about the pros and cons of thrombophilia testing, particularly in the setting of a person who's already had venous thromboembolism, and that the fact that a person has an overproduced DVT puts them at an increased risk in and of itself for them having another one, independent of any genetic markers they may have to be particularly hypercoagulable. So that risk would be about 30% in 8 years of having a second episode for anyone who's had one already. And this 30% doesn't really increase in persons who have thrombophilia defects, such as protein C, protein F deficiency, antithrombin. And the article really talks about how, if this is the case, then a decision to test for these disorders is perhaps not necessary because the risk of having a recurrence is going to be the same just by the fact that you had one. So if we start, you know, as practitioners testing everyone who has had a DVT and provoked, we can sometimes find false reassurance in not treating them prophylactically longer, even though their risk is really the same because they've had one in themselves. So that's what it talks about. There are, you know, some instances where the authors of this article felt that data would indicate some benefits to thrombophilia testing, such as women who are, you know, considering becoming pregnant or going on birth control, who are coming from families where there is this high incidence of venous thromboembolism, and to have that information in mind for these women, to know the risk that they're taking by going on birth control or, you know, potential miscarriages, and to be able to make the decision to perhaps prophylactically anticoagulate in that situation. So.
What a great review by Nicole. Thank you so much, Nicole. That's terrific. Like Nicole said, we read an article, the evidence-based approach to thrombophilia testing, which appeared in the Journal of Thrombosis and Thrombolysis. And so I'd refer interested listeners to that source article. And what this mainly focused on was thrombophilia testing of factor V Leiden mutation and prothrombin G mutation. It kind of left out the anticardiolipin aspect, which I think makes sense. So I think the reason that this came up for us was because in clinical practice, I see a lot of people ordering thrombophilia testing, but it's unclear to me how thrombophilia testing should affect their clinical management. So as we order the test, we should be thinking in terms of how it affects our management. And I agree completely with Nicole that clinical factors would seem to outweigh thrombophilia testing factors in terms of making anticoagulation decisions. So sort of to further bolster that, I had looked up an additional article that's in the Canadian Medical Journal that's sought to identify patients at with unprovoked or idiopathic thromboembolism at low risk of recurrence who could safely discontinue therapy. And the factors they looked at were sex, whether the person had hyperpigmentation in their leg, a D-dimer greater than 250 micrograms per liter while taking warfarin, a BMI greater than 30, age greater than 65. And the group that they found was at the lowest risk of recurrence were women with zero or one risk factor who had an annual rate of recurrence of 1.6%. But women with two or more of these findings had an annual risk of 14%, so they would seem to benefit from indefinite anticoagulation, as well as men. For men with an unprovoked venous thromboembolism, they could not find a low-risk subgroup. And so this study is going to be followed up by a study trying to clinically incorporate this. But I think what it brings to mind is I think a lot of times people are using the thrombophilia profile in order to make a long-term decision about Coumadin that I think is probably ill-advised. So their patients are presenting with venous thromboembolic disease. The thrombophilia profile is being ordered. The profile is saying, oh, you don't have an inherited or a predisposition to clot based on this lab testing, therefore you can stop blood thinning. And I think that the fact that they had a clot indicates their predisposition to clot. And I guess the other thing I would say that I struggle with is that some of the risk factors, I struggle when there's a minor risk factor for clotting that's likely to be recurrent. So patients who have, particularly when travel is the risk factor, patients who go on a short flight or a car drive, that they're likely to repeat fairly frequently and develop a clot, or a long-haul truck driver who develops a clot, who plans to continue long-haul truck driving. Those patients I struggle more with, but I tend to favor anticoagulation. So, Nicole, did you have any additional thoughts? So I guess my take-home from this article was basically thrombophilia testing is only really helps in some very particular circumstances, mainly for women, mainly in regards to contraception choice or perinatal concerns, but it doesn't seem to be for all comers. So I'll kick it back to you if you had any final thoughts.
Just one comment. Originally I had been thinking about this sort of in having a patient that was a little bit hard to convince of having definite anticoagulation after DVT, and realizing that medicine is developing, there are possibly all these other deficiencies that we're unaware of that are genetically making the person's hypercoagulable, and how the thrombophilia testing that we have now may be inadequate to account for all of the factors in a person or in a person's family that would give them higher risk. So just thinking about trying to approach that way with patients to say that aside from these genetic factors and these blood tests we can do, you've had an DVT, that in itself means that there's something in your body that makes you more likely to clot. So this is our reasoning for going ahead with the definite anticoagulation.
Well put, Nicole. Well put. I couldn't agree more. All right. So kind of switching gears, somewhat inexplicably, but just I guess what's ever on Nicole's of my mind here today. Switching gears to delirium. Nicole, I don't know if you would be able to enlighten listeners regards to delirium and prevention, treatment, any thoughts that you have?
So, delirium in the hospitalized patient is obviously a huge problem for anyone who's worked in a hospital knows. And I think the results of my brief research was that definitely the standpoint that we should, as practitioners, be most focused on is prevention of delirium. Because once someone has become delirious, particularly in the hospital setting, multiple comorbidities, it's extremely, extremely difficult to sort of get them out of that in a timely manner with really any treatments that we have. So, you know, these studies where hospitals try, you know, orientation protocol, you know, early mobilization, and visual hearing aids, really treating the underlying like cause of why they're in the hospital, obviously giving them sleep aids, sure that they're, you know, as oriented as they possibly can be in the confusing environment of a hospital, which seems very disconnected from regular life and the rest of the world. This showed a this protocol of orientation showed a significant reduction in the number of delirium episodes. So it was 62% versus 90%, which is pretty significant when we're talking about something that's very hard to quantify, very hard to prevent. The only other thing I saw that was shown to has been shown to be prophylactic is how Marinol was administered in a study as a prophylactic treatment to one of the older hospitalized patients after hip surgery in particular. It didn't reduce the incidence of delirium, but it reduced the severity and duration of the episodes, which I thought was interesting. So I think this is a potential, you know, medication that we can use, but prophylactically, not after the fact. You know, it's really damage control once someone has become delirious. You know, and managing their behavior to make sure that they don't hurt themselves or others and trying to orientate them as much as you can, but it's really a very difficult thing to deal with once as they've entered this acute confused state, they've sort of already signed on to this increased morbidity and mortality. It's very unfortunate.
Well, again, Nicole, what a wonderful overview. Okay, so a couple of things that I would, I guess, reinforce and add to what Nicole said is I looked at two articles. One, now more than a decade old, was in the New England Journal in 1999 with a multi-component intervention to prevent delirium because, as Nicole, I think, correctly points out, with delirium, we're much better off with a prevention strategy rather than a treatment strategy. And this strategy that they utilized and has since been developed and used in a number of hospitals was mainly focused on risk factors for delirium. So reorienting, getting proper sleep, early immobilization, helping vision and hearing, and trying to prevent dehydration. And so I think locally, what I think we could improve on is perhaps in terms of sleep in particular, I think we're much too quick to pharmacologically manage sleep. And as Nicole and I were walking around, I think we could definitely improve on the amount of extraneous noise that's probably contributing to a lot of disorientation, particularly in our elderly patients, which is our largest cohort of patients. So I think that definitely the prevention I would reiterate. And then the other thing I would reiterate was the effect that delirium in the hospitalized patient has. So this is from JAMA, July 2010, delirium in elderly patients and the risk of post-discharge mortality. Was a meta-analysis, and this indicated a risk of death in a 22-month follow-up of 38%, as opposed to 27% in controls. Increased risk of institutionalization. A third of those with delirium were subsequently institutionalized. And a risk of dementia, which was more than half in the delirious patients, in 8% controls. So it's associated with a poor outcome independent of co-founders. And so once delirium develops, it's just as Nicole stated, damage control. So I guess we kind of had two things today that were similar in terms of preventing, preventing clot and preventing delirium. So maybe that's how we can connect the two. So I'll hand it back to Nicole because it looks like she has some additional thoughts here about delirium.
Looking at these lists of drugs that cause delirium and confusional states, I think much would be benefited by, I guess, my own personal further research, because the list is so extensive, and for dealing with persons that are in the hospital, it's virtually impossible to avoid these agents. So I'm interested to see which ones are the top 10, because this list is, just all these patients are on all these medications.
I guess I would say my thoughts on the medicines that we manage are we always need to look at the risk and benefit, and therefore look at what medicines are necessary and what are extraneous. So, opioids are obviously on the list of things that can sometimes cause delirium or confusional state, but I think also we have to realize that pain can contribute to delirium. So for someone who's fractured a major bone in their body, I don't think it's the right thing to do to withhold medications that may help them with pain, and in fact, withholding such medications may in fact provoke delirium. But one of the reasons I kind of harp a little on the sleep aids is here because I think that's more of an extraneous medicine. So I would say we want to limit the sort of extraneous medicines as much as possible. I think also we need to look at the other factors that contribute to delirium, hearing impairment, vision impairment. So I think a lot of our patients come in with a hearing impairment. They're being woken up a lot. There's a lot of people coming in and out of their room, and this all leads to confusion. So that would just be my, just like with any medicine, I think we look at trying to evaluate the relative risks and benefits. So that's it for today, and I'd like to thank Nicole for joining us on this podcast. Thank you to all the faithful Community Hospitalist podcast listeners for your ongoing support. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to contact us. Take care until next time.